2. The End of Eternity. Foreword. Another novel of mine grew out of a smaller version, and in this second case, matters were more extreme. Pebble in the Sky was only 1.4 times as long as Grow Old Along with Me, but my novel, The End of Eternity, was 3 times as long as the story out of which it developed. It happened this way. The year was 1953, and nearly 4 years had passed since the publication of my first book, Pebble in the Sky. Since then, I had published 8 more books, including a biochemistry textbook, for 9 altogether. My 10th book, Lucky Star and the Pirates of the Asteroids, Doubleday, 1953, was about to appear, and my 11th book, The Caves of Steel, Doubleday, 1954, was being serialized in Galaxy in preparation for book publication. I was averaging 3 books per year in those early days, which, given my rate of writing, was not very much, but I didn't have much time to write then. Half a year before Pebble in the Sky appeared, I had begun my teaching duties at Boston University School of Medicine, and in 1951 I had become an assistant professor of biochemistry. I was still under the delusion that this was my life work and that writing was just a sideline, but I kept writing just the same in odd moments. Occasionally it was necessary for me to visit the Boston University Library on the main campus. Those were its pre-Gottlieb days. And on November 17, 1953, while wandering through the stacks, I came across a file of bound volumes of Time. I began leafing through the early ones and was naturally amused at how much wiser I was than the Time writers, with their carefully cultivated style of know-it-all arrogance, because I had the benefit of hindsight, of course. I asked the librarians, without much hope, if it was possible to take out those volumes for home reading. I then discovered that faculty members had some extraordinary privileges. They could take out such volumes, though students couldn't. I promptly took out the first of the volumes in their collection, which covered the first half of 1928, and moved onward steadily. It took me almost a year to work my way through all the volumes, and the librarians called me, with what I hope was affectionate amusement, the Time Professor. The whole procedure was merely a matter of pampering an impulse, except that in one of the early volumes I noticed a line drawing in a small advertisement. Glimpsing it out of the corner of my eye, I got a flash of something that looked like the now familiar mushroom cloud of a nuclear bomb. That startled me, for the volume of Time was some 15 years before Hiroshima. I took another look. It was only the old faithful geyser of Yellowstone National Park, and the advertisement was perfectly ordinary. But what's the use of being a science fiction writer if you don't take advantage of odd little things like that? Where do you get your crazy ideas, I'm frequently asked. One answer should be, from old issues of Time magazine. After all, what if the advertisement were what I thought it was, actually the mushroom cloud? Could the words of the advertisement offer a subtle hint as to the true nature of the drawing? If so, how did it get there, and why? Clearly, the matter had to involve time travel, which was at once interesting, for I had never written a major story involving time travel. So on December 7, 1953, I began to write a novelette, which I called The End of Eternity. It turned out to be 25,000 words long, and I was finished with it on February 6, 1954. I was very pleased with it, and I mailed it off to Galaxy at once. On February 9th, Horace Gold phoned me. It was a complete rejection. He talked revision, but a total one. It would have amounted to my jacking up the title and running a new story under it. I refused point blank, and that was that. It seems to me that I should have tried Astounding then, but I didn't. I no longer remember why, and I have no indication in my diary as to why I didn't. I've noticed many times that when something unpleasant happens, I don't say much about it in my diary. My diary may, therefore, give a more carefree, happy-happy impression of my life than is truly warranted by the fact, though my life has been happy enough, to be sure, and I wouldn't dream of complaining. It may be, and I'm just guessing now, that from Gold's telephone conversation I got the idea that too much was happening in the novelette, and that I had a dehydrated novel on my hands. Since Doubleday had now published 4 of my novels and had 2 more in press, I felt like an established Doubleday writer who could make use of the perquisites that come with the post. It may therefore have seemed reasonable for me to ask Walter Bradbury to read the novelette and tell me if he thought a novel was hiding in it. On March 17, 1954, when I was in New York, I left the novelette with Bradbury, who good-naturedly agreed to humor me. My judgment this time was accurate. Bradbury said that I had a worthwhile novel there, and on April 7th he called me to say that a contract was in the works. I signed the contract on April 21st, and was then faced with the prospect of retelling the story at three times the length. It took me exactly half a year to do so, and I was finished on December 5th, 1954. Within a week, I submitted it to Doubleday, and on August 4th, 1955, I received an advance copy of the book. Here, then, is the original novelette from which the novel was prepared.